You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Now, every episode of Table Talk features visionaries from across the food industry, digging deep into the latest innovations and spilling the beans on the secrets of how it all works. But today's episode should really be a quantum leap in terms of understanding how food affects our bodies. We're going to find out the secrets of how to tag a molecule of protein from food, then trace it through the digestive system and find out which part of the body it ended up in. This is the truth about protein nutrition. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a broadcaster, and I'm a gastronaut. Now, protein is fascinating, partly because of the endless uses being found for it across the food industry. It's cropped up in pasta, in biscuits, and in popular chocolate bars. But it can also be a murky world of health claims and shades of truth. So many of the claims made about protein in terms of nutrition and fitness seem, well, frankly, ambitious at best. Can they really all be true? But even if protein isn't actually magical, it's certainly popular. This morning, a Google search offered me 141 million search results. It's a protein-rich rabbit hole. So, to guide me through it, I'm joined by Dr. Richard McKenzie, a research centre director in the School of Life and Health Sciences at Roehampton University. Hello there, Richard.
Afternoon, Stephen.
It was originally going to be morning, wasn't it?
But it's now. I was hoping.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so just to start off with, I wonder, have you had a big wedge of protein at some point today? We're recording this nearly 5 o'clock. You must have lunch and breakfast. So what was your protein hit for today?
I skip breakfast these days, so I go straight into eating around lunchtime. And my lunch today was, yes, it was chicken. Big lump of chicken.
Big lump of protein.
Yeah.
Very good. Now, your work is about how foods affect us at both a cellular and a whole body level. So can we start with the basics? Just if you can give us the landscape with which we're dealing with. What is protein and why do we need it?
Well, we talk about protein, but protein is made up of smaller molecules called amino acids. And when we ingest the protein, we then break that down and use that as the building blocks of our cells, our bodies. And we're talking about using those amino acids to build and repair and grow muscle.
Is it muscle for muscle to some extent? You eat a fair amount of protein. It mainly goes towards building muscle?
It goes to other processes, but the majority of amino acids, once they're absorbed, will make their way across to muscle and be either stored as muscle or will be in what we call the intracellular compartment. So it'll be in a pool that's there and readily available to make new muscle. I mean, one example you could say with how important amino acids or proteins are to muscle and therefore health is that your bicep muscle, most of our bicep muscles, will replace itself entirely within 2 weeks. So the turnover of protein is quite rapid. There are other uses, of course, but muscle is probably the most important in this context.
So that's quite well said, isn't it? It's a pool of protein that is available should your body need to use it to make muscle. Now we talk about amino acids. We talk about, people certainly talk about the idea of a complete protein. Is all protein the same? I mean, how does it feature metabolically?
No, not all proteins are the same. That makes studying protein quite hard. Not all amino acids are the same. There are essential and non-essential amino acids, and they're metabolized slightly different. And that makes it very hard to understand the metabolism of amino acids. So we have to use some complex procedures. So what we do in my lab and in others is we tag amino acids when we put them into the body so they can feed, and we can feed them, and then we can follow that particular amino acid around metabolism. So one example is we would then take blood samples and muscle tissue samples to see how much of that particular amino acid has been incorporated into the muscle. And then we can test things like, well, if we take X supplement, does it actually do what it says on the tin? Does it improve or increase muscle protein synthesis? Because we know directly that tagged amino acid is being incorporated into the muscle and what rate that happens at.
I love the sound of this. And now, as long as we're not going to get too deep into the minutiae, how the heck do you tag protein?
We'll tag amino acids. So the protein is the largest structure and we can tag the particular amino acid. The way to try and visualize it is to look at a fluorescent tag that you might look at underneath a scan. And in this example, what they do is we make the chemical structure slightly heavier. Mm-hmm. And then when we get the sample out at the end, we can look at the ratio of the untagged versus the tagged amino acid. And then from that, we can work out how much had been incorporated into, say, muscle.
That's a beautiful thing. So you can track the molecules through the body and where they end up.
You can, yeah. In humans, it's slightly different because you can't just take all the tissue out you want. You can't take the liver out and your pancreas.
You can take mine. You can take mine. Yeah. You have to go on me. Yeah.
You can certainly have mine. But this is exactly. We can infuse it into the bloodstream, and then we can measure over different time points from the muscle in this example and see how much is being incorporated into the muscle of that particular amino acid that's been tagged.
Yeah. Oh my God, this is fascinating, but we've got to stop talking about that. We've got to start talking broad strokes again, just in case everyone else isn't as nerdy as you and I. Okay, so on a broader stroke, in an average non-athlete, healthy person, how much protein should we be consuming on a daily basis?
That's an interesting question because, as you mentioned right at the beginning of your introduction, it's a murky field and you get sort of different bits of information from different sources. The NHS, so we're in the UK, and different countries have different recommendations, would suggest 50 grams per day for the average person who's consuming 2,000 calories a day. Mm-hmm. The RDA, so that's a recommended daily allowance, so around about 0.8 grams per kilogram of body mass. So for the average male, it might be 64 grams a day. And that's for the average person consuming, mm-hmm. A normal, typical diet, but not exercising too much and has no underlying health concerns.
Yeah. So the RDA aside, it seems like quite a small amount compared to the amount of meat that you get in most meals. Would you say that that's correct?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most people are consuming easily two grams per kilogram of body mass, over double.
More than double.
I just mentioned. Yeah.
Yeah. So for something like chicken, if you had the piece of chicken that you had for lunch was 250 grams of chicken, how many grams of that would likely to be protein, do you think?
Yeah, so that's tricky. This is where I normally farm out my scientific work to others. So
it's a broad guess.
About half of that, if not a little bit more, is going to be actual good quality protein.
Okay. Now, is there a sort of chrononutrition aspect to this? Is there a time of day that we should be eating? You skip breakfast, very naughty boy. It used to be thought as very naughty, not so much anymore. Does it make a difference when we eat our protein?
It appears it does, actually. And it seems that the end of the day before sleep would be a good time to have one of the biggest protein doses. So mm-hmm. It seems that the end of the day is probably the time where you could, you most benefit from having the biggest protein load. So if you were looking at timings, the suggestion would be, I think it's around 0.3 grams per kilogram per meal of protein, whatever that meal is or whatever the timing is. But the biggest protein load they were recommending is at the end of the day, so up to about 0.5 grams per kilogram per meal.
Okay, so we're looking at people having a lot of protein generally. Obviously, nutrition varies very widely across the population. But is there a problem with excess protein? Can too much protein be bad for you?
There is a notion that it can be bad for kidneys, and there's a notion that it could probably be bad for muscle. And in reality, there is no proof to suggest that at all. On the flip side, my research is looking at the molecular and the whole body responses to things like nutrition and other interventions. And what we find with the way insulin works and the way the response to amino acids or protein as IGF works is there's very similar links when you get inside the cell. So what I've been doing is understanding those two processes. And what we find is that in experimental models, when there is too many amino acids and glucose for that matter, it can start to interfere and inhibit and cause problems on both sides. So the insulin-like growth factor and the insulin pathway. And that's largely where my interest lies. So what that means in the real world is potentially too much amino acids in the wrong, depends which way you look at it, or the correct environment could cause things like insulin resistance, which could then cause things like type 2 diabetes and obesity.
And what stage are you at with your research? So you mentioned that there are indications. Are you likely to publish in the near future?
Yes. Yeah, we will. We don't have the answers to it in humans, and we're probably one of the first in the world to look at it in terms of this context in humans. there have been a lot of experiments and animals and cell cultures which have shown negative effects, but they are very simple cultures and simple animals compared to a human. Mm-hmm. So we just finished that work and we're just analyzing it at the moment. And so this should be out around Christmas time. Yeah. My gut feeling, although I should say the experiment's blind, so I have no idea what the results are going to say. And by using the word gut, and no pun intended, but my feeling is that there is no such thing as a bad or a good food. It's only in excess it becomes a problem. So anything we know in excess is a problem. You know, the history tells us that. And so too much of a good thing in this context is probably not going to be a good thing in the wrong environment. If someone is eating well generally, although they might be on the higher end of amino acid nutrition, exercising well and has no underlying health conditions, it's very unlikely that it's going to cause any major problems. But if anything is upset, so they might be obese, or they might be pre-diabetic, they might have cardiovascular disease, mm-hmm. then there could be a potential for a problem. Mm-hmm. The only downside to that is chronic diseases, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, insulin resistance, hypertension, high blood pressure, are all chronic diseases in which the threshold for clinical diagnosis is well beyond the starting point of when problems start. So they start much earlier on. And it's only when it spills over into the blood or the blood pressure goes up that we clinically diagnose it.
So I guess that it goes back to the father of toxicology, Paracelsus, who I think, what's the quote is, everything is a poison. There is nothing which is not a poison. It's the dose that makes the poison. So at some point, too much protein, you know, just you know, you can drink too much water. Eventually, you know, you'll imbalance your system and water can kill you. So having too much protein, probably not a good idea. So let's think broadly about, yeah, so this is a very much a food industry focused podcast. A lot of the people that we work with talk about protein, and they talk about it as it's a selling point of some of their products. A lot has been claimed about protein. Is there any particular claim about protein that makes you spit out your tea? Do you think that people go too far and make broad sort of positive claims about something that possibly does not warrant them?
I think with protein, it's actually, it does offer a lot of good. And if you want to build muscle mass and look good, it can help you do that. I would argue when you get to a point where it's too big, you're going to cause your body some problems along the way, because it's a bit like gravity. It's only going to come back down. And so that's what will happen with that muscle. And it also helps with weight loss, because protein is metabolically very demanding to consume and digest and put in the right places. So it takes a lot of energy, and therefore it has a good weight management aspect to it. Mm. And it also suppresses appetite. And that probably comes again from an evolutionary perspective, where it releases hormones that help down-regulate our drive to eat. So it has a lot of benefits. There's no doubt about that. What does upset me is that it's seen as a product almost that you have to be able to get from a supplementary source. It can't come through your diet, and that's how it's marketed. And that does rile me, because there's no evidence, particularly in a Western world, where, you know, to suggest that we can't get what we need in terms of amino acids or proteins from a healthy diet. Mm-hmm. And vegans can even do that. There's so much available, you know, out there. So that does bother me.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk by SOFA nutritionists with their slightly fruitcake ideas occasionally, that protein is an important tool for losing weight, and that I think this is bandied around a lot without any particular specifics. It doesn't really say anything other than eat lots of protein. It's a really good, really, really good way to start losing weight. Without any kind of functionary kind of device in there, i.e. do something else with your diet or use it in a different way. Is protein the answer if you want to lose weight?
Oh, there's no one answer to weight loss. There's lots of things that go into why people are overweight, and the environment, etc., that you live in is one of the major problems. It surprises me that there aren't more overweight people given how we live our lives. But does have lots of good potential benefits for weight loss, but I believe on a whole body level it's marginal. Mm-hmm. You know, it can easily be offset by the wrong kind of diet or lifestyle.
Protein has become a sort of real buzzword, which I would imagine probably sticks in your throat a little bit because you've been fascinated with it for years. But certainly in the food industry, everyone is talking about it as a sort of an extra ingredient. You know, there are, I mean, I can't tell you the amount of products that I hear about who they've just started doing a protein supplemented version of a popular product. Now, what is it that has created this huge interest? Is it all rooted, do you think, in the muscle and fitness industry, or are there other things? You know, things like survival rates from cancer, healing from surgery. You know, there's lots of talk about these things being helped by levels of protein. Is there some level at which you can say having more protein in your diet of decent sources is going to help certain aspects of physiology?
What I do know from different ages and different populations that anything above 2 grams of protein per kilogram of body mass will not award you any more benefits than less that. So if you consume 3 grams, for example, it's not going to give you any more benefit than the 2 gram. And so there's a threshold. And there are people that would benefit from more. So older individuals benefit from having more protein. So their threshold for muscle protein synthesis is 0.39 grams per kilogram of body mass versus a younger individual, which would be 0.25 grams grams per kilogram of body mass. So there's definitely, you know, there's definitely populations where people would benefit, but there is an upper limit. In terms of protein ending up in different products, I think that, you know, one is it's a marketing tool to sell products. You know, we go back 10, 20 years or whatever it was, and we knew everything, you know, in the supermarket had 0% fat in it, and fat was the issue. Fat was the problem. And so we were consuming a large amount of carbohydrates. Now, carbohydrates are the problem. We're cutting out carbohydrates. We're not necessarily introducing fats unless they're healthy fats, but protein can do no harm at all. And we just don't know that. We're putting it into our bodies and we don't know. And it's likely, as I said earlier, that providing everything else is equal, you're healthy, you're fit, and you're doing, you know, everything else that you should be, and there's no underlying health concerns, it's not likely if you consume too much protein over time that's going to cause you any issues. However, if you're finding amino acids and proteins dumped in things like pasta and other dishes you wouldn't expect them to, you can easily get to a point where your protein consumption is well above what it should be. And do we know if that's going to cause any health problems in the future? The answer is no.
No, we don't.
But could it? Potentially.
We're going to pause the interview for a second. I should just mention a couple of other recent additions which are really relevant to this conversation. We had a fascinating addition on how protein supports immunity a couple of months back, and another asking whether protein from insects could be the next sports nutrition craze. They're both up on the website and they're really worth checking out. Find them at foodmatterslive.com. Now back to the interview.
I would argue better quality protein sources are obviously, you know, going to deliver more amino acids and better.
What would you call a better protein source?
Well, what I mean by that is, I went to a barbecue when I was lucky enough to get out of lockdown. And, you know, increasingly there are more vegetarians and more vegans. And I am a meat eater, but I do understand the environmental concerns. So, you know, I'm all in agreement of that. Probably what I'm less in agreement of is that perhaps the protein sources from a vegan source perhaps should be in a diet, tofu or a salad or something of that nature. And what they're doing is they're flipping out the sort of processed meat burger and exchanging that for a processed vegetarian burger. Mm. And that's what I mean. That I don't believe that's a good protein source. And you'd be better off, you know, getting your protein from a sustainable local source, even if it is meat rather than a processed source.
So it's almost as though the protein is the same. It's the vehicle that it comes in is the thing that can be bad or better or worse.
What really strikes me is how we are now consuming foods that are not part of the normal food matrix. So for example, Nick Bird, really good friend and works at Illinois, he has made his whole career on protein, just protein, as he jokes. And what they showed is that if you consume a whole egg versus part of the egg, gram for gram the same in terms of the amount of protein, the positive benefit from the whole egg outweighs any benefit you got from just one source, that isolated part. And I think we're missing the trick a lot with that, by delivering amino acids or proteins in supplementations, and we're losing the trick a bit on that if we deliver amino acids or proteins in the source of processed foods, whether that be burger or vegetarian. And I think that's important, because generally in research, when we're looking at protein or anything else, we generally are looking for markers, whether that be in the blood or any other tissue, that are associated with negative consequences. What we are just starting to look at is what's happening the other way. So we're looking at, you know, things that we didn't know about, rather than just things we think are involved. And so we're seeing a lot of scope for future research that tells us we know very little about how our bodies respond to, you know, interventions such as protein or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. But within the scope of what we do know, what you know specifically, I wonder, is there one secret that you just wish you screamed at people about protein, that you wish that everyone knew? One thing that is a little lurking thing that's very obvious to you and the researchers around you, but the public just isn't really aware of or doesn't take seriously?
No, sorry. No, I think, do you know what, I frustrate people, Stefan, because I very rarely go to that extreme where the extreme is the, you know, is the norm and the thing that works. Well, actually, it's more in the middle. Yeah. Sorry to frustrate, but...
Well, I salute your defying a journalist's attempt to soundbite you, so that's fair enough.
I had a good soundbite, I would have come up with it.
Now, you mentioned that there are certain groups of society that may not be getting enough protein, or that could do with more, and you mentioned older people possibly. I mean, obviously Britain has a complex set of nutritional profiles, and there's a lot of socioeconomic disparity. Are there certain groups that you are concerned about that may not be getting enough protein, other than the elderly? Or is it that generally speaking, most people in the UK get their fair share of protein?
I think we're lucky in living in the UK that we do get our fair share. We're starting to learn a lot about certain populations that might not be getting enough. And so, you know, it may seem counterintuitive, but those that are carrying excess weight and therefore body fat are not handling and not processing the protein they are ingesting well. Their metabolism is seemingly defunct. And so that would suggest they need more to get the same effect. And the problem with that is that then could, by having more, ingesting more, could cause, you know, more problems down the line.
Yeah.
And that's a complex issue, and it centers around, for me, insulin resistance. And then there's populations, you know, you mentioned cancer, you know, that they suffer sarcopenia, or something called cachexia, which is the, you know, it's a muscle mass loss that's induced by cancer. You know, we know that they need more, you know, amino acids, more proteins. And then recently we did some work on those suffering from kidney failure, so maintenance hemodialysis patients, and they, you know, another population that seems to need more amino acids. You know, they're not processing the protein they are ingesting as well as they could do.
Are there different requirements for people recovering from COVID?
Are there different requirements?
Protein. Do you need more protein when recovering from COVID, or is it pretty broad dietary recommendations?
As far as I know, it's broad dietary at the moment. I mean, you could argue it'd probably be more carbohydrate based, given it's an inflammatory condition, over protein. I haven't seen much evidence on that yet.
Now, on a personal level, what kind of relationship do you have with protein in your diet? And you know, I'm not expecting you to follow your own rules, because that's not how it works. But I'm just interested in your relationship with protein. Do you think you see it in a different way to somebody who's not a researcher in the field?
Do I see it as a different way?
When you're having lunch. Well, literally, when you're sitting down to make a meal.
You know, we talk about that. We're talking about it now, is how much protein should you have? And I'm giving you very specific 0.2 tenth of a gram per kilogram of body mass per meal per moon. You know, the moon must be out on a certain time of the day. That kind of thing. And actually, what we do is we eat foods, you know, as a whole food, and we eat as part of it. That's how I see protein. I don't sit down at a meal and say, okay, is this going to be my 0.3 grams per meal that I need to maintain protein synthesis and to be the healthiest person of myself, you know, version of myself? No, I eat protein. I enjoy protein. I know it has health benefits from eating a varied diet, and that's how I kind of view my dietary intake. And I enjoy food.
And when you cooking or with family or friends, do you find yourself sort of looking at that slab of protein that they're about to cook and just churning it over your mind and sort of holding yourself back from making a recommendation about intake?
On how to cook it or how much?
Oh, well, let's get into the Maillard reaction then. Now we're talking about protein.
No, I hold back from any kind of comments. But what I do actually is that whenever my wife will back me up on this, whenever there's a meal, I do look for, where is that protein part of it? And it's meat protein. But I do try, where possible, to make sure it's, as locally sourced as possible for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But I very much enjoy it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the athletic supplement industry is huge and growing enormously as well. We haven't really talked about that side of it, of working with athletes. But what impact does protein have on high-level sports performance? Is it crucial to have a huge extra wedge of it from your protein shake?
No, I'd say protein shakes are, for most, including elite athletes, are useless because they get what they need from their diet. So happy to go on the line with that one. There is enough protein. They're working with nutritionists in the diet. Now, there are some Tour de France cyclists, for example, may consume or need to consume, because they're expending 9,000 calories per day. Not every day, but some days. So there may be an instance where that kind of supplement becomes useful. Because they just can't digest and hold that much food in one go. And then it depends on the sport. So amino acids for a Tour de France cyclist would be just for repair, really, because they're not really going to rely on amino acids for energy. So it's about repair and, muscle repair and growth, and mostly repair, as much repair as they can during the Tour de France. Whereas, a scrummaging front row forward in rugby, their amino acid intake will be, slightly higher than an endurance athlete, but their requirements for the energy needed is going to be slightly different. It does make a huge difference, to answer your question, in the period after, so how well they repair and the recovery from the event, from the sporting event or from training, is very important.
That is really important. Yeah, and you're right. At the end of the Tour de France, you don't get any of those cyclists saying, "Oh, well, that was a good workout. Now I'm really ready for action." It's about surviving, isn't it?
Yeah, barely, just getting through. Yeah, and trying to get enough protein in their body so that they can repair and actually keep some of the muscle mass they started with
and keep going the next day. So, last couple of questions for you. I know we're running out of time, really, but we haven't even touched on insect protein yet and different protein sources like that. I am particularly fascinated by insect protein. I've been looking at the area quite a lot and made a few documentaries about it. Interesting tool. I mean, again, as you say, protein is protein. But are you interested in different sources of it and also the sort of the protein to input ratio and things like that? Does that ever touch on your research?
It doesn't. No, I mean, it's obviously something we read about, we know about. From my perspective, looking at it from a research perspective and trying to understand, does it have legs? And so that's my third pun, I think, not intended, but I just think it would require too much energy, really, to turn it over to be of use. But I haven't really looked into it. I could almost ask you the question because you.
Yeah, I'll send you a pack over, but you'll have to pull it apart for me and stick it under a microscope.
Yeah, exactly. What roles for something?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say I do have an interest in. So in the lab, what we're able to do is grow and mature muscle cells. So they might come from primary sources, from different animal sources, and there is a growing interest in growing cell cultured muscle into edible muscle. And I probably see the future, my guesswork, whatever that means really, or whatever that adds in that industry over the insect industry.
Yeah. And again, it comes back to this idea of inputs and outputs, how much protein goes in various different forms or how many amino acids go in to how much protein you get out. And can you get that ratio as clear, as close to 1-to-1 as you can? Okay. So last question then, really, what are the things in protein research that really excite you? What's at the cutting edge? What are the answers that you think we need? And what are the questions that need to be asked, either with your work or with work that you see in the field at the moment?
I think for the questions that we need, society needs from protein research in terms of our diet is to understand a little bit more about how much our bodies actually need. So like every method, I mentioned a method I use and others use routinely, and it's sophisticated and it's useful, but it has limitations. We put in one amino acid, phenylalanine as an example, and label it. And then we infer that that's whole protein metabolism, a whole body metabolism. So we're starting to do that. We're starting to, others are doing that really well, putting in multiple traces to really understand metabolism. So that will help us understand how much we need really, and whether timing makes a difference. And then, there's this particular populations, whether it actually adds anything to, disease populations, and whether, improves health outcomes. I think that's important, because if it does, then we should be reviewing that rather than introducing another drug. Because I won't get started on that, but there are major problems with how our bodies respond to one drug versus two drugs. And then there's the next part, I would say, is there any long-term benefit, or is there any long-term problems with over-consuming proteins in our diet? That I think we need to answer, because if we don't answer it, we may get the answers put upon us, in 10 or 20 years' time, when we realize we've been overdoing it and we find ourselves in the same boat we seem to be in with consuming too much carbohydrates currently. So I think they're the major questions.
Okay. Well, really looking forward to your work being published, hopefully in the new year, I guess.
Great.
That's it really for this one. Dr. Richard McKenzie, thank you so much for talking to me. I have to rethink breakfast from now on, whether or not I need them, and certainly with a big wedge of protein. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts, in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, all the way from protein to food security to the ag tech revolution. Recent highlights included editions on intermittent fasting, food health claims. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatterslive.com. Thank you so much for listening.